May 27th, 1983, interview with Mr. Elliot Abrams.
Yeah. I guess the first question here, what was really the overall Reagan administration policy towards Cuba? Was there, when the administration came to power, was there really any interest in overthrowing Castro? Were they going to, of course you read my paper, you know what my focus here is that there was a continuity. Mm-hmm. And I want your opinion on that. Am I wrong or am I on the right track?
I do not have anything to do with Cuba policy until 1985. Mm-hmm. So I can't tell you what the initial Cuba policy was like. I can't tell you anything about that. By the time I got involved in Latin America policy in mid-85, there were two strands, I would say, to the three policy. One was to fight against Cuban subversion in Central America and elsewhere in the region. A second was to work with Cuba on a few issues, one of which was, I suppose, the hijacking agreement, another of which was the immigration agreement, and a third was Southern Africa. And there were always, as you know, conversations between not only the intersection, but at times my COSAC. I always refused to meet with the head of the intersection.
You refused to meet?
Yeah.
Any reason for that?
A matter of principle. We didn't have diplomatic relations, and I felt that they could conceivably use such a meeting as propaganda purposes.
I was Ramon Sanchez Parole.
At that time, yeah. But, as you know, the statement which is frequently made, that such and such would happen, so many things would be solved if we would only talk to them, is a ridiculous statement, because in fact there were talks going on about something or other often, and there was no difficulty in communicating through diplomatic channels. Then you come to the third strand of policy, and that is, well, what about Cuba itself? About the internal situation. And there I think it's fair to say that there was no real effort to overthrow the government. There was an effort to prevent, there was an effort to avoid doing anything that helped the regime. For example, we were very unhappy about Cuban participation in various international sporting events, and we tried to make that very difficult for them. And we had long arguments and fights with the Pan Am Games people in 87 or whatever year it was. And we did not try the Carter-style rapprochement with them. And we attacked them much more than they had ever been attacked before in the United Nations and the Human Rights Commission. But with respect to overthrowing the regime, for example, covert action to overthrow the regime, for example, real efforts to subvert that regime, that was not something that the administration was interested in.
Was not something they were interested in. Okay, was part of this due to this secret agreement between Kennedy and Khrushchev?
I don't think so. I think, you know, if you were of a mind to do things, you would reach that question very quickly. I'll present you with a program, and then someone will say, wait a minute, you can't do that because of the Kennedy-Khrushchev agreement. We never got there, at least not in the period that I was involved. We never got to contemplating any serious action against Cuba which could be considered a violation
of the agreement.
Yeah.
Okay, now, let's see, let me take a step at a time here. You talked about the interest in talking with Cuba about hijackings, of course. Now, in November of 1984, the immigration agreement had been signed, but then on January 1st of 1985, Ismail Labit, the prisoner that had killed the eight people down the Virgin Islands, hijacked the plane to Cuba. And I believe State asked on three different occasions for Cuba to return him in January, February, and March of 1985.
Do you know anything of that matter?
No, I was not in the Latin America during that. I don't remember anything.
Okay, because I find it interesting that when Cuba refused to return him in March after the third time, then this process for Radio Martí speeded up.
Yeah, I don't know.
And the station came out in May of 85. Okay. You also talked about this, the programs of the cultural, sports, and educational exchanges. But they did seem to increase, they seemed to continue this policy that had been set out by Carter.
I think that's fundamentally right. The problem there was, you know, generally speaking, nobody's interested in Cuba except the Cuban-American community. However, that's not quite true. The left is interested in Cuba. And the one place that you see that is cultural, educational, and athletic programs, where there had been created a kind of a pro-Cuba attitude. Well, there was a pro-Cuba attitude, and they were constantly trying to pressure the administration. Well, you know, a singing group, an orchestra, a band, a violinist, a shot putter, whatever. Our attitude towards that was that we would not try to close that loophole, that it just didn't matter that much for the cultural events. And there were times when we permitted them and times when we didn't. We were tougher than the Carter people. We did not close it down. I don't remember the outcome of the attitude of the Pan Am Games people in Indianapolis was sports and politics don't mix. We did not want the Cubans there. And so we made all sorts of trouble about, you know, charter flights and things like that. I would say it was a kind of halfway house. We tried to be an obstruction, but we did not say no more.
Because the same thing later happened when the Tropicana Cabaret Review visited the U.S. At first it was denied, then they let them come. And some of these academics, too, were coming in the program, were later denounced by DGI defectors as being Cuban intelligence operatives that were coming.
Well, that's what we, you know, assumed in any group, athletic, musical, whatever, a certain percentage would be DGI. You know, we're always guessing quite what the percentage was. But a certain percentage would be, and that's one of the reasons we didn't like it. But, you know, you start, when you do that, you start getting editorials in the Washington Post, New York Times, and the city, whatever city it is, and the congressmen and the senators, what do you mean? This is crazy. All we're asking for is this singer, this violinist. So on some of those occasions, it just wasn't worth it. I would add one thing since you raised DGI. I would say that one of the things that, one of the problems we had in dealing with Cuba was we had no intelligence. There were countries, you would expect a place like El Salvador that were very well covered. But even, you know, take a country that wasn't all that important to us, like Bolivia or Colombia, Venezuela, important from the drug point of view. But we had some idea of what was going on. But in my opinion, the intelligence on Cuba was very poor. Almost non-existent, and it came out at a certain point in the late 1980s that virtually all of the people who had been American intelligence assets were in fact doubles.
Right, that's after the Aspillaga defection.
Yeah, so it's not surprising we didn't know what was going on.
Although at the same time, Cuba accused the United States of running a espionage network out of the interest section down there, and named, I believe, about 20 Americans there.
Don't
comment. Hey, you replaced Langhorne Motley in, I believe it was April of 85.
July.
In July of 85. What was the reason for that? Why was he dismissed? And
having a clue. I just got a call one day from Schultz asking if I would do this.
From Schultz?
Yeah. From his assistant on his behalf, and then I met with him later that day. I don't know. I hardly ever seen any speculation about it. It's kind of funny.
Some people feel that he wasn't, that he was replaced because he wasn't following the Reagan hardline towards Cuba.
I doubt that, because he had no great interest in Cuba. But he certainly had no ideological reason to be soft on Cuba. And he was replaced by Schultz, who was no hardliner on these issues. As you see from his memoirs, he was, I think, what you call a moderate. And so I don't know the answer to your question. It's a good question.
Okay, I recall that one of the first things that you did regarding Cuba was when you met with the Cuban bishops in September of 85, when they came to the United States. Do you recall what that meeting was about, or what was discussed? Or?
I have a very, very vague memory of the meeting, and it may be wrong, but my memory is that we were all struck by the fact that there were some Catholic churches that, when they were oppressed, fought back. Chile, for example. There were some in Eastern Europe where the church had become the center of opposition, Poland. And there were some places in this hemisphere where that happened, like Chile, where the church was the center of opposition to Pinochet. As a matter of fact, that's true in a lot of the South American countries. And we were struck by the non-protesting nature of this visit. They didn't want to talk about all of the terrible things that were happening to the church, the prejudice against it, the difficulties believers had. They really were here more to help the regime, I think is a fair way to put it. I mean, I don't know if they saw themselves that way or not, but in essence, they were asking for everything to be sweet and calm and smooth. They were not here asking for more militant behavior against Castro.
And were they asking for American concessions?
As I recall it, they were against the embargo because it hurt the people of the island. There was a history to this. I mean, we early on, it wasn't 85, it might have been 85, certainly it was 86. I remember testifying in the House on religious freedom in Cuba, House Human Rights Subcommittee. And I testified that there wasn't any, and it was terrible. But there were two representatives of the Catholic Church in the United States, Tom Quigley and Father Brian Hare. And I'll never forget Quigley saying, the church in Cuba, it's a quote, the church in Cuba is a quiet church. And we were amazed. I mean, it turned out that was, of course, the way the bishops were acting too, but no protests, no outrage, no opposition to the regime. They took whatever crumbs the regime gave them. But I remember the bishops, as I say, very vaguely, but I remember them as being basically arguing that, you know, let's improve bilateral relations. That was the main line.
Okay, in November of 1987, when the U.S. Government began pursuing this line of condemning Cuba before the U.N., the first vote that went down, there were about five Latin American countries that voted against, voted in favor of Cuba. And news media reported that you met later with five of these diplomats. And
five diplomats who what? Say it again.
The what? That you met with five of the Latin American diplomats later to raise a protest or
about what?
Oh, that they had voted that they had not voted with the United States. That they had voted.
Yes, that's true. We did that repeatedly.
Okay. Let's see, just to give you a direct quote, you met in Washington with the ambassadors of Argentina, Peru, Venezuela, and Colombia, all large recipients of American economic aid, to register objections to their anti-U.S. vote.
Well,
the same message was later sent to the Mexican ambassador.
Venezuela and Argentina are not large recipients of U.S. aid.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But yes, we did. We always did, because we, you know, the argument we made was, this business about not criticizing dictatorships, this comes from the days when Stroessner wouldn't criticize Trujillo, and, you know, you're democratic governments now, you should do this. And of course, there were two reasons, I would say, why they wouldn't criticize Castro. One was this old tradition that you don't come in on the internal affairs of somebody else. And this is a terrible tradition, and they're eliminating it step by step now. And the other was fear. Blackmail. At one point, the foreign minister of one of those countries said to me, Do you know what Castro could do here?
Do here, meaning where?
Here in my country, he said. With one signal from Castro, you could have all the trade unions out on strike, you could have thousands of students throwing stones at the university and closing down classes, you could shut down the whole downtown area of the city. And I said, that's blackmail, that's extortion. And you let Castro do that. And he said, well, that's life. So it took years for them to move slowly in the direction of the cyber.
And okay, now also, let's talk a little about the U.S.-Cuba immigration agreement. Now, at the time, I believe you had some type of disagreement with Vernon Walters about the usefulness of the agreement. He said that that the immigration agreement, the second time when it had been renewed, he said it was in an inappropriate moment. And
I have no memory of this. Have you talked to Mike Kozak?
No, I haven't.
Do you know who he is?
Yes, he negotiated the treaty.
Right, he's still in the State Department. Right now he's working on Haiti. But he's still around. He did this. I really have no memory of, when.
Respected Walter's criticism and called the accord a significant diplomatic achievement that would make a major contribution to human rights.
Well, one thing we were not going to have was the UN ambassador determining Cuba policy. And I think I probably was surprised, I'm surprised now, that, that Walters would have thought that he would be consulted on something like the Cuban immigration agreement. Being a UN ambassador, a lot of people think, makes you this sort of auxiliary secretary of state, but it doesn't. This had nothing to do with the UN. The details of it, I just don't remember. But one thing the Reagan administration was very clear on, they did not want another Marriott.
They did not want another Marriott.
They did not want another Marriott.
But why didn't the Reagan administration take a tougher stance towards Cuba with this immigration agreement? I mean, there were suggestions that the criminals be sent back on an expandable ship. Governor Graham suggested they'd be put in Guantanamo Naval Base and pushed across a fence there. And even during the invasion of Grenada, mm-hmm. 1983, the Congress passed a non-binding resolution to send them all back with the Cuban prisoners of war. Yet, why does the administration spend 7 years going to a negotiating table and not take a tougher stance against Cuba on this issue?
What would the tougher stance have been? Military force?
Well,
pushing people back across the border is a military confrontation with Cuba. Reagan didn't want that. You have to remember, George Bush used force an awful lot more than Ronald Reagan. Reagan did not like using force. And I think it's fair to say, if you look at that agreement and you look at it in the context of 8 years, that getting rid of Castro was really not on Reagan's agenda. It was just, in a situation like this, the immigration agreement was seen in large part, I think it's fair to say, as a, how can I put this, as a, not as a matter of foreign policy, not as a potential tool against Castro, but as a way to solve what was in essence an immigration problem and to a certain extent a potential domestic political problem.
Well, also in the situation with Cuban officials involved in drug trafficking into the U.S. in November of, I believe, 1982, there were four Cuban officials that were indicted, yet the Reagan administration seemed not to have taken any steps even towards bringing these people to the U.S.
How would you do that?
Well, for example, one of them, René Rodríguez Cruz, one of the indicted people, was traveling in Germany, West Germany. You know, the U.S. could have asked West Germany to...
When was that?
He was indicted in 82. He was traveling in West Germany in 84.
Yeah. Again, you're before my time, but I don't know whether anything was done in an effort to get him. I'm quite confident the Germans would never have done it. You know.
Also, the same situation arises with Cuban-sponsored Puerto Rican terrorism on U.S. soil. We see that Puerto Ricans were setting off bombs in New York City. They were murdering American sailors down in Puerto Rico in 1982. They were firing anti-tank rockets at the FBI and Marshal's office down in Puerto Rico and publicly stating this is in reprisal for the invasion of Grenada. And they robbed $7 million from a Wells Fargo depot in Connecticut. And Attorney General Edwin Meese came out and said, yeah, we know half the money's in Cuba and the person involved on the inside on the robberies in Cuba. Yet, you know, again, we don't see any type of reprisal against Cuba to the extent that was carried out during the Libyan bombing.
Yeah, because you're in the middle of the Cold War, and bombing Cuba is not the same as bombing Libya, because Cuba is a Soviet vassal, and Reagan did not want a confrontation with the Soviets over Cuba. I'll give you another example. We proposed at various times quarantining Nicaragua. Prevent the arrival of Soviet arms directly or transshipped to Cuba. Could never get anybody to go for that, because what happens? Every day, every morning, you wake up and you have a confrontation with the Soviet Union. If there's a Russian ship and there's the U.S. naval ship, what are you going to do? Shoot it? You're going to sink it? There was no taste for that in the administration. The confrontations with the Soviets were diplomatic, or they were through third world proxies. The use of force was also indirect. I mean, Libya, which is not a Soviet satellite, Grenada, which was trivial, or the use of proxies like the Contras, the Afghan, Mujahideen, and UNITA. When it came to direct confrontation, the administration didn't want them. Thus Haig's business about going to the source, you know, which did not happen.
But the administration didn't even want to use Cuban exile proxies in their fight against Castro, right, while they were backing all the other groups.
Yes, because I would say, partly because in the case of Nicaragua, Afghanistan, and Angola, you did not really have a consolidated government in the sense that you did in Cuba. And probably more important, the others did not bring you into confrontation with the Soviets. Direct confrontation. I mean, they did, in, you know, indirectly, but it's not the same as a U.S. vessel and a Soviet vessel, a Cuban vessel.
Even in the question of broadcasting to Cuba, like Radio Martí, here the U.S. has this policy, okay, we're going to broadcast to Cuba. But then when Cuban exile organizations like Hugo Matos Cid or Alpha 66 or the Brigade set up their own stations,
yeah,
to broadcast to Cuba, or Cid even later tried to beam TV reports to Cuba, the FCC came and cracked down on them and said, no, you can't do this.
That was not a political decision that the administration made. We were handed that decision by the FCC, and we could never see a legal way around it. Now, TV Martí is another thing. TV Martí we actually did, although it may or may not have been a good idea. I mean, it's actually technically very difficult to do TV against jamming. The FCC decision was not, I think, a politically dictated decision. It was a factual decision which was then not reversed on political grounds.
Now, I understand that even within the State Department, there were conflicts between people in there who wanted to take a harder line towards Cuba and others who wanted to take a softer line.
I'm sure that's true. I mean, it's always true.
Mm-hmm. Can you expand on that, or who wanted to take harder line, or what the... Because there was a lot of... there was a turnover there, a lot of... U.S. interest section chiefs down in Havana.
Remind me who were there. Who were the people?
Taylor was down there. Was
right, and then he was replaced by Kamen. Is that how it worked?
Kamen, and there was...
Those
Right, and prior to him was, something junior.
Well, Taylor was not in favor of rattling their cage very much. J. Taylor was more of a traditional diplomat. Cameron was more suspicious and I think less susceptible to... I mean, I think it's an institutional thing in this sense. You are a diplomat. You're a career diplomat. You've been doing this your whole life. You've done it in five different countries. Now you go to Cuba, you want to do it again. And all of these restrictions make it impossible for you to do what everybody else in the diplomatic corps is doing and what you used to do. And Taylor didn't like that and kept trying to expand his ability to reach out inside Cuba and talk to more people in the government, for example. And so he and I had some fights about that. Ultimately, he lost, mostly because he left. Cameron was
Taylor left?
Well, he finished his, his 3 years. Cameron was by personality more reserved and more scholarly and was a Sovietologist and viewed this, in a sense, as a kind of paid vacation from Kremlinology to be in this, Soviet satellite where there were a lot of Russians around and where he could speak Russian all the time. And so he found it intellectually fascinating, but he didn't have this desire to go socialize and get out more and be a sort of more traditional ambassador. In that sense, we had fewer conflicts between the Bureau and Kamen. The stuff about Walters you mentioned, I didn't remember. Jose Sozano was at the NSC for part of this period, and of course, was interested in the hard line of Cuba too, though I really don't remember him protesting very much.
He eventually resigned because of that.
Because of what?
Because claimed the administration had taken a harder line against Cuba.
Well,
Cuba and Panama.
The administration certainly did not take a hard line against Panama. It was a terrible mistake, which ultimately led to the invasion. A lot of lives lost that could have been saved. And we all protested. I mean, we all argued about that. We just lost the arguments. I don't remember many arguments in favor of a harder line Cuba policy. At least I don't remember Jose arguing with me. Now maybe he felt that, we were doing all we could to toughen up the policy and that we were losing for whatever reason, but anyway.
Is there anything else you'd like to add to the interview that comes to mind? Or?
Well, one thing that we did do with respect to Cuba that I think can be exaggerated but can also be underestimated was we did lay the foundation very well, and it was built on by Bush, to make Cuba a pariah at the UN. You go back to 1980, Cuba was sitting pretty. At one point they chaired, I think, the UN Human Rights Commission. Think of it.
No, the Security Council.
Yeah, but they were members of the Human Rights Commission.
Right, they were members of the Human Rights Commission, but they chaired the Security Council.
And we really plugged away at that. I mean, credit goes to Gene Kirkpatrick, Mike Novak, Dick Shifter, me, a lot of people. And as time went by, and this is during the Cold War, it became easier when the Czechs and the Poles and everything were on your side, but more and more countries began to distance themselves. Cuba became controversial for the first time. And I think that was an important first step in changing the way Cuba is viewed in the world, from an essentially positive view to an essentially negative view.
But then again, Cuba alleges that that the U.S. is pressuring a lot of these countries, and they even refused the U.N. Relator to enter Cuba. So.
That's all right. The purpose of this was in the long run to improve the situation in Cuba, but nobody thought it would improve in the short run. The purpose was to hurt Castro in the international scene, to reduce his prestige, to sully the name of his regime. And when the UN votes for a special rapporteur and they don't let him in, that's in a certain way that's good, because he wasn't going to achieve much inside anyway. This way it's clear to everybody how bad Castro was and how much in the outside the consensus he was.
And I guess the last question would be, looking in your crystal ball, what do you see here for Cuba in the future?
Well, I think I have been too optimistic with respect to the decline of the regime. I really thought it would go the way of Eastern Europe, but I have, taking a further look at it, I think it's, you know, the truth is that it is not fundamentally a communist regime. And by that, let me be very precise. It is not like, say, the Czech regimes, where it didn't matter who the leader was, or East Germany, it didn't really matter. It is an old-fashioned tyranny using the intellectual...
Caudillismo.
Yeah, it really is using, of course, the powerful intellectual and political tools of communism to make it even worse than any Caudillo ever was. But the fact that it is a Caudillo regime means it's hard to get rid of. Because a lot of Caudillos stayed until they were dead. Franco being an example.
Trujillo.
Yeah. So I think, and it also shows you why the collapse of communist regimes doesn't automatically mean that this one goes. So when does it go? Well, I think it goes if he gets sick. He doesn't have to die. If he gets a heart attack, a stroke, I mean, then I think things begin to crumble fast. I have a mixture of optimism and pessimism. The optimism is on the economic side for all the obvious reasons. I mean, if you draw up a list of what does it take to succeed economically, and you look at, for example, El Salvador and say, as I do, well, you know, and you compare that list, that's looking pretty good. They're going to grow. Even better for Cuba, because the nature of the people and the diaspora and the American market and so forth. However, I have some doubts about the political situation. It isn't easy. It's not easy anywhere. We see this in Guatemala and Peru and El Salvador and Nicaragua. It's never easy. When you had a country that has been under a communist regime for this long and had a mixed political background before then, why assume that you'll have a velvet revolution? And there are other problems. For example, what is the role of the exile community? What about the race question, which gets into the exiles again? But it can be a divisive factor in a free Cuba.
And one of the problems with that race question is that Castro has put most blacks in the repressive apparatus.
So I think part of this is luck. You know, if you ask, well, why is it that, you know, everybody needs a George Washington. We were lucky. Uruguay was lucky. They had Sanguinetti. The Venezuelans needed one too, and they got Perez. The Haitians got Aristide. I mean, sometimes it's more than just a system. I really think there is such a thing as luck, too. And maybe there will be a Marti figure. And maybe there will be some bum. Maybe there will be a thief like Perez. Maybe there will be a divisive figure like Aristide who wants to make sure, it wouldn't be surprising, you know, who wants to make sure that the people who deserve punishment get punished. Or in his view, deserve punishment. So I think the real problem that Cuba has to face after Castro is whether the economic progress that is easily possible will be disrupted by political instability. And I hope the answer to that is no, mm-hmm. and maybe the answer will be no. But I'm just not sure the answer is no.
I see sort of a possibly a repeat of what happened in Cuba in 59 with the overthrow of Batista and 33 with the overthrow of Machado, where the populace went out in the street and hunted down these state security people and, you know, dragged them through the streets. There was a lot of bloodshed.
Yeah. It's natural. I mean, it happened in France when the Nazis were defeated, the occupation. A lot of people had scores to settle. It's
right.
It'd be natural to expect that. And I guess I should add one other thing. There is always the danger of a really violent fin de regime.
Of a really violent?
Fin de regime, end of the regime.
Oh, mm-hmm.
I don't think the problem is so much Castro doing something crazy like bombing Florida. Because if he were crazy enough to give the order, the Air Force wouldn't be crazy enough to take the order and do it. But I think what is conceivable is to have some uprisings here and there. Food riots, student riots that turn into something. And some of the police won't put it down, and then the army essentially put it down, and some of the police defend against it. That kind of thing, if particularly if Castro is ill,
like in Romania,
that he's ill, yes, that's plausible to me. And that, number one, that could mean real bloodshed. Number two, if it goes on for a few days, not 3 months, a few days, where there's a real uprising here and there and there, and it's being put down bloodily by Castro, you're going to have very, very loud calls for American intervention or OAS intervention. And my hope is that as in Romania, the regime collapse, once that starts, I don't think it's going to start tomorrow, but my hope is that once it starts, it goes very fast.
It goes very fast.
You don't want the regime to crumble slowly. You want it to crumble fast to avoid bloodshed.
But possibly with American intervention, it might rally this nationalistic anti-Americanism.
I'm not in favor of American intervention in that situation. You have another problem. I think you're right. There is the danger that that helps Castro. There's another danger. If you put enough troops, you can get rid of it fairly quickly.
Like Grenada?
Well, like Panama. And the reason I say that is you will cripple the successor regime if it comes in on the backs of American soldiers. That's bad. What you want is a regime that can really stand up and say, we had a revolution in this country, and the communists hijacked it under Castro's leadership, and thank God that's over, and now we return to the authentic democratic revolutionary tradition, build a new Cuba. You really can't, and you steal the nationalist banner. You can't do that, you know. The Americans put you in very hard, looking in barrel.
Right.
I mean, he had a great situation, and he was really elected president. He really was. Still, he has never been able to work himself out of London. I've got to run, I think, looking at the time.